That is, of course, the hardest working man in show business, James Brown. He's the subject of an HBO documentary that was released last fall. It's called Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown. And this week, we learned that it won a prestigious Peabody Award. These are awards given for distinguished achievement and meritorious public service by broadcasters. When the documentary first premiered, we spoke with the filmmaker Alex Gibney, as well as Michael Veal, a professor of ethnomusicology at Yale University, and Fred Wesley, former music director with the James Brown Band and a longtime trombonist. I started by asking the filmmaker, Alex Gibney, about the focus of the documentary.
I think what this film is about, it's about how James Brown changed the culture. I mean, he took music from kind of the big band era right on up to hip-hop through funk, and that was big. And then he also had a huge impact in a political way, but the way he connected politics with culture in a very, very, very powerful way.
And he was called the hardest working man in show business. In fact, he even references that in a clip that we've got right here.
If I can be the hardest working man in show business, I think that's an attribute to music. I demand discipline. Not keeping your shoes shine, not keeping your suits pressed. A lot of the young people that throw their suits down and not realize what that means to them, a uniform. They don't still have the sense of pride. They should be glad to put on a uniform and belong to something.
Fred, he talks in this film about show business, not just being about show, but being about business. And it sounds like he most certainly understood the business side of things and ran his empire.
He really did. And he taught me a lot about the business, too, because I came into the band green and I learned, for example, he told me on Soul Power, he said, I'll give you $125 or 25% of this tune, you know. So I said, well, give me the $125. I had just came in from California and I needed a coat. So the $125 is gone. The coat is gone. But the 25% he also gave me is still coming in. It's still coming into now. So that's one thing he taught me about the business.
Michael Veal, how did he get that nickname, the hardest working man in show business?
I think he got the nickname by being the hardest working man in show business, by being out on the road something like, what, 300 nights a year, probably?
At least. Yes.
At least. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone was working that hard.
Well, why did he? Why did he feel the need to work that hard, especially once he had achieved the amount of success that he had?
I think he had a determination to get on top and stay on top, whatever the cost.
And we hear in the film from people like Mick Jagger, who still look up to the amazing showmanship of James Brown. We also learn about Alex Gibney, James Brown, from the very beginning. He was abandoned by his mother at a very young age and ended up for a while in his aunt's brothel in Augusta, Georgia. Tell us about his early life and how that contributed to his approach to his work.
You know, there was a lot of pain in that for him, and I think he carried that throughout the rest of his life. And it came out in somewhat unpredictable ways. But I think it also gave – it animated a kind of focus and determination and drive in him that really pushed his music. I mean, Fred would be better to speak to this than I would. But
Well, Fred, tell us. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, he had no hobbies. He only did music. He only did entertainment. That was all he was about. He didn't go fishing. He didn't go to football games. He didn't do any of that. And he worked his band just like that. You know, if you was in the James Brown Band, you could look to rehearse for hours and hours until you drop.
And he really almost created his own style of music. And Michael Veal, like a lot of African-American musicians, his early career started out in gospel, but then he really shifted to a style that you could really only describe as James Brown.
Papa's got a brand new band.
Well, it was funk. He was one of the main innovators of funk. Not only James Brown, but the musicians around him, like Mr. Wesley, Jabbo Starks, Clyde Stubblefield, Jimmy Nolan, Pee Wee Ellis, Bootsy Collins, Fred Thomas, and on down the line. These were all architects of that style, and Brown wasn't as musically trained as the rest of the musicians, but I think ultimately his band was his musical instrument. You know, he was out front orchestrating all of the energies and channeling them out into the audience in a way that has never been done before or since. And, you know, you have to keep in mind that whole concept of discipline and uniforms and all of that came out of the big band era.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that the film tries to get at is that we all know James Brown as a performer, as a great performer, and a great singer. But his role as a band leader, you know, is really something that this film, I think, was able to bring out.
Fred, I want to ask you a question because you've probably seen this very funny sketch that Eddie Murphy has done where he plays James Brown. And one of the things that he makes fun of is the idea that perhaps the other members of the band couldn't understand what James Brown was saying when he would call out to them and say something.
Hey, Matthew, that won't people know you now. Sit down, 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 down. Find the people, they jump back. Want to kiss myself.
Did you understand every word of direction that he would yell out in the middle of a performance?
No, but I understand the signal. You know, he would give a signal of what to do, you know, go through the bridge and come out of the bridge, go back to the vamp. You know, James Brown, his manner of speech is a form of South Carolina speech called Geechee. And people who are Geechee can understand that, but other people have to stay with it for a while to understand it, you know.
Now, the documentary ends in the mid-70s at the height of Brown's career, but it was before some career decline, drug abuse, domestic violence charges, rape charges. Now, the film is called The Rise of James Brown, but why not include some of the fall?
I think we wanted to focus just on that one period. We felt that the whole... I think we included some of what would come to be the fall and some of the seeds of that fall, but we just felt that to do a kind of life and times, do the full life, would be a bit like stone skipping. It would only get at the surface. But I think we chose to focus on his impact on the culture, and that was most powerfully felt up until about 1974.
Fred Wesley, before we end this conversation, I do want to ask you for a favorite memory of James Brown and working with him.
Well, my favorite memory was the movie scores that we did. I knew nothing about doing movie scores, and we did a movie called Black Caesar. And he didn't see the movie. He didn't want to see the movie. He told me to watch the movie and to do the score. So that was a tremendous pressure on me to do that score without James having seen the movie and with the producers wanting one thing and James wanting another thing. And to the point to where the premiere of the movie, he actually fired me. He fired me in the premiere, but he hired me back when he realized when everybody was congratulating him on what a great movie score he had done. So that's one of my memories, but I have all fond memories of James Brown because he gave me an opportunity to learn how to record, to learn how to write, to learn how to take care of business. And most of what I know from James Brown.
Fred Wesley, longtime trombonist and music director with the James Brown Band. We're also speaking there with Michael Veal, professor of ethnomusicology at Yale, and filmmaker Alex Gibney, whose HBO documentary, Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown, won a Peabody Award this week. And a quick note before we take a break about a new survey on happiness. The third annual World Happiness Index from the Sustainable Development Solutions Network finds Switzerland is the happiest country in the world, followed by Iceland, Denmark, Norway, and Canada. The least happy countries are Rwanda, Benin, Syria, Burundi, and Togo. The survey bases its rankings on data from Gallup, as well as GDP per capita, life expectancy, and corruption levels. The United States comes in at number 15, just behind Austria and Mexico, but ahead of the UK, Taiwan, and Italy.